for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Department of Justice announced yesterday it would not charge Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown, but it also issued a scathing report outlining what it called a pattern of discrimination against African Americans by Ferguson police and municipal courts. Here to talk about the report, what it means for civil rights and police departments around the country, Jamelle Bouie of Slate.com, Carrie Johnson of NPR, and Ronald Hosko of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. Joining us from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, David Harris of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. But first, joining us from St. Louis, Missouri, Emmanuelle Berry. She's race and culture reporter for St. Louis Public Radio at member station KWMU. And Emmanuelle, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having me.
Indeed. Talk about the reaction out there to these two reports, the first on the death of Michael Brown and the other on the Ferguson police themselves. How are folks there reacting?
I think in the case of the Darren Wilson report, you know, there were leaks in January that were saying that this would be the expected result, and I think that's what a lot of people expected. But I think for some people, particularly activists, you know, it's still upsetting that this is the conclusion that was reached. The Brown family released a statement expressing their disappointment in the Justice Department's decision not to charge Wilson, but they also at the same time said they were encouraged that the DOJ is acknowledging the wrongs of the Ferguson Police Department in that second report. And the reaction to that report was also kind of, hey, we're not that surprised. You know, there are statistics and reports that already point toward bias policing, and, you know, people have lived this experience. That's why a lot of people were out there protesting because of the treatment by police. So people, in a way, I think, feel validated by the report. It's, you know, a federal body saying this is really happening. You need to change. And, you know, I heard a lot of activists say, you know, they're glad that it's been done, but they're not sure what's next.
I think many were, all of us, surprised about the racist emails attributed to members of the police department in that second report. Can you give us some examples of those emails? What did they say?
Yeah, there were several emails. I think it was a total of seven that were published in the report. And they're emails saying things like, one of them says, you know, there's no way President Obama will be president for long because what black man holds a steady job for 4 years? Depiction of the president as a chimpanzee. There's this horrible joke about a black woman having abortions as a form of crime deterrent or a way to stop crime. And there's also, you know, mocking of African-American vernacular English. So just, you know, these very kind of casual tossing around of racist comments.
I gather there was also an email mocking or a photo mocking Michelle Obama.
Yes, there was one. I think it was of people dancing and saying it was her high school reunion, or it was like an African tribe dancing, and it referred to it as her high school reunion. So, yeah, just a lot of things politically aimed, as well as, you know, more basic, just about the way people speak.
Emmanuelle, last night the mayor of Ferguson, James Knowles, gave a press conference. What did he say, and what was the community response?
So he kind of didn't say much. At the press conference, he didn't directly kind of respond to the DOJ's report. He didn't say whether the city would enter a consent decree with the DOJ. He didn't say if anyone would be fired, which is a question a lot of people are asking. Is who's going to be fired, or if anyone will be fired. But what he did say, he said that the report allowed the city to identify their problems and that the city needs to work to address these racial disparities. And he also listed the changes that Ferguson has made since Michael Brown was killed in August. So he mentioned, you know, changes to the court system, efforts to recruit minority police, as well as trying to work on a citizen oversight board. But people really wanted more. They wanted more specifics, and they wanted more of a sense of accountability from that press conference.
And the question becomes, what about Police Chief Thomas Jackson? He was not there at the press conference. Is he likely to hold on to his job?
I think at this point we really don't know. We don't even have a sense of whether or not they're going to go with the consent decree or what the city's next steps are. I think a lot of people are definitely asking for the police chief's job and want him to be dismissed. But you know, we're just really not sure at this point what the next steps are.
And what about the municipal courts in Ferguson? Any announcement regarding changes there?
Well, municipal court reform is something that actually for the past couple of months there's been a lot of talk about reform. So there have been meetings talking about municipal court reform, as well as, you know, in the state government there have been, you know, calls for municipal court reform for potential legislation. So that's something that's being worked on, but it's not necessarily something that has actually happened yet. But I think that the DOJ, this is just another instance of them saying, hey, you need to clean up your act. This needs to change.
And in regard to those emails, I gather one person involved in sending those emails has been terminated still. There are two others under investigation.
Yes. At the press conference yesterday, Mayor James Knowles said that after the Justice Department discovered these emails, there were three employees involved, and they were put on administrative leave, and one has been fired, and yes, the other two are under investigation, according to Mayor Knowles.
And are you aware of any protests planned for the coming days?
Well, last night there was actually a smallish protest at the Ferguson Police Department. About 50 people were there, and I think people were there kind of as a reminder, you know, that this is a problem, this needs to change, and also because the report confirmed what a lot of, you know, activists and protesters have been saying about African Americans being discriminated against by police. I think there's also a real sense that I don't know if there will continue to be protests. Protests have been sporadic for the past couple months, and I think they'll probably continue to be sporadic. But, I mean, I think the reason people are still out there and people are still doing things is because they really want change. And I think the greatest fear is that after all of this, it won't.
Emmanuel Berry, she's race and culture reporter for St. Louis Public Radio. She joins us from member station KWMU. Thank you, Emmanuel, for your reporting.
No problem. Thank you.
And to you, Carrie Johnson, tell us a little more about the report and the reasoning behind not indicting Officer Darren Wilson.
As Emmanuel said, this conclusion had been previewed for months now. Still, there was some new information in this Justice Department report. What the Justice Department has said is that they found nothing, despite interviews with 100 people who claim they were eyewitnesses, a review of ballistic evidence, a review of physical evidence at the scene, nothing to discount Officer Wilson's statement that he was in fear for his safety when he shot 18-year-old Michael Brown. And in fact, the Justice Department said all of the physical evidence it reviewed supported Officer Wilson, that there was a struggle in the vehicle for the officer's gun, and that Michael Brown charged or moved toward Officer Darren Wilson. All of those conclusions were things that had been contested in the court of public opinion for months. And moreover, the accounts from some eyewitnesses that Michael Brown had raised his hands as if to surrender, the Justice Department found not credible. Many of those eyewitnesses, DOJ investigators said, did not actually see anything. Others changed their story or recanted over time. So this entire movement founded on the issue of, or the idea of hands up, don't shoot, may have been, the sentiment may have been real, but the hands may not have been up in a gesture of surrender.
At least the evidence was not conclusive that that had actually been the case. I wonder how many people the DOJ heard from.
So they interviewed 100 witnesses at least, and then FBI agents went around the neighborhood knocking on the doors of residents in Canfield Green and nearby areas just to find any other witnesses, any other evidence. They made an exerted effort to uncover what happened through the eyes of people who were there at the time.
Carrie Johnson, Chief Justice Correspondent for NPR. When we come back after a short break, you'll hear from Jamel Bowie at Slate.com, Ronald Hoskins of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, and David Harris, Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh. Short break. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects while undergoing treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. From Citrix with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at gotomeeting.com. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
And in this hour, we're talking about the Department of Justice decision. It would not charge Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown. Jamel Bowie is staff writer covering politics, policy, and race at Slate.com. In that second report, Jamel, they found there was widespread systemic racism inside the Ferguson Police Department and the local courts. Can you give us some of the examples in that report?
Yeah, there is. What was striking about reading the report is that it seemed as if every other page there's some example of some issue of abuse or prejudice or racism. The ones that stick out to me. In one instance, a 32-year-old man is sitting in his car after a basketball game, and he's approached by a police officer. He is asked what he's doing, and the report notes that because the windows in his car were perhaps tinted darker than what was allowed, the officer had reason to approach him. But what happened after the approach was the officer asked him if he were a pedophile. When the man responded sort of in dismay, the officer in question began to escalate the situation, and it ended with him being taken into custody, receiving several citations, and losing his job. He was a federal contractor, and the citations, I guess, violated the terms of his employment. There's another instance where a husband and wife are with their two young children. They're outside of a park. They're by their car. The two young children are using the bathroom in the bushes nearby. It happens. A police officer approaches them. The police officer asks what they're doing. They tell him. The police officer then says that he might give them a citation for exposing their children. When they begin to protest, he then threatens to arrest the husband. The wife asks a question. He then says he is going to arrest the husband because the wife asked a question. And this whole thing ends up with both of the parents in custody for reasons that are – I said you have no idea why this has happened other than they happen to talk to this officer in the wrong way.
And you've got – percentages, don't you, Carrie, of blacks as opposed to whites being charged in this way?
There's a lot of data in this Justice Department report. About 67% of the people in Ferguson are African American, but African Americans account for about 90% of people who are stopped in vehicles and 93% of people who actually face charges, even though the Justice Department has found they're less likely to carry contraband in the vehicles than white people. Moreover, Diane, in terms of use of force, this involves tasers, weapons,
Canines. Yes.
All 14 incidents the Justice Department found where police dogs were sicked on people involved African Americans. One involved a 14-year-old boy who was huddled up unarmed in an abandoned house.
And one thing to emphasize, there's no indication that African American residents of Ferguson are responsible for more than their share of crime in the area. There's no indication that this is a response to actual conditions or a requirement of the policing happening. It really does seem like explicit targeting of the African American residents of the city.
And as a reporter, I gather you spent time in Ferguson.
Yes.
How were you received?
Because I was I was in the car most of the time, and because there is, I think, I was there in the middle of everything. And so police were just kind of concentrated by the protest, I didn't really encounter very many police driving around. I will say that once I was around officers in the area, and this might have just been because I was obviously a member of the press, there was, like, a lot of wariness. But, you know, for me, I didn't experience anything out of the ordinary, but talking to lots of people there, virtually everyone you asked, if you just said, what has your experience been like with the police? They could give you a story, or they could point to friends or relatives who have stories, not stories of just like casual disrespect, though that is common, but stories of abuse, of being accosted, of being of facing violence from the police.
And now, David Harris, I want to turn to you at the University of Pittsburgh. If the Department of Justice found such widespread racism in the Ferguson Police Department, how could it be that Officer Wilson was not charged?
Well, because, Diane, there are really two different questions. In order to charge a police officer with a homicide, say, with any kind of crime, but a homicide, excessive use of force has to be the issue on the state level. If we go to the federal level, then they not only have to prove the excessive use of force, but this was a willful effort to deprive the victim of constitutional rights. That is among the highest standards in the law. It requires the strongest possible case, and even in the strongest cases, oftentimes the Department of Justice simply cannot prove these police violence cases under that very, very high standard. In contrast, the case against the police department, that's different. It's about what is the institution of the police department doing that shows a pattern or practice of the deprivation of constitutional rights. And here, that pattern was very, very clear outside of any bad incident with Officer Wilson. There was wholesale violations of the Fourth Amendment, arresting people without probable cause, stopping them on the street without reasonable suspicion. There was interference with their First Amendment rights, and this was all a matter of routine with that police department, showing a pattern. So that's what that case is about. It's different than an individual crime.
And what about leaving the chief of police in place, considering everything you've just said?
Well, it's a question really for the leaders of Ferguson at this point. The chief of police is responsible to the mayor and maybe the city council. And if they think that he's the man to lead the department forward at a time like this, when there have been these scathing allegations in this report that are so well documented, if they think he's the man to lead them forward, then I suppose that they are entitled to keep the man if they want. It's really their choice. At this point, it seems to an outside observer like that would be a mission for another person, but they're politically accountable to the voters, not us, and so they may choose to keep him, they may not.
All right. Ronald LaHosca, what was your reaction to the report and first to Darren Wilson's being not charged?
I have a couple of reactions. I think that those in law enforcement would suggest that the Attorney General, in the timing of these announcements, effectively buried the lead. What got us here was this intersection between Darren Wilson and Michael Brown last August the 9th. That inflamed many in the country, and I think we saw, as Kerry mentioned earlier, now some almost 7 months later, the Attorney General is announcing that there is no evidence that supports any version of events other than Darren Wilson's. There was no evidence that Michael Brown was running away or shot in the back or all the other allegations that drove protests all last summer and fall. And as I listened to the Attorney General make this announcement yesterday, I'm just guesstimating, I think he spent about 3 minutes on Darren Wilson and about 20 on the rest of Ferguson. But the triggering event was Darren Wilson and Michael Brown. I think that, and Kerry referred to it, this false narrative that took us through the fall, this hands up, don't shoot, didn't happen. It didn't happen. And so the Attorney General, in trying to make his case, spent much of his time on the Ferguson Police Department, the broader issues.
All right. What about the systemic bias outlined in the second report, including those hateful emails? Isn't that cause for great concern?
It absolutely is. The report is very troubling. Jamel and Kerry, referred to pieces of it. It is very troubling. It's a different standard of proof. I think, though, we have to, sitting here today, this is day one after the report was made public, we have to pull back and look at the allegations against Darren Wilson last summer. Looked very bad, and many in the media fanned that narrative. They repeated it, and it looked like Darren Wilson shot an innocent child in the back. And here we are 7 months later, and that wasn't true. So today, these are allegations by the Justice Department, and I think we have to take a reasoned, rational look at it and figure out how much of this is anecdotal, how much of this is backed by data. What does the data really tell us? You had an interesting show yesterday on science and how we process data. And we have to go through that process now. There will be a back and forth between the city government and the federal government on these matters. At face value, what's contained in the report is very, very troubling. And if true, it's an infection not only in the police department, but in city government there, because there were other drivers. The city manager was clearly aware there were discussions, widespread discussions, about driving revenue, more fines. So this is a bigger problem than just the chief of police. How much did the mayor know? Does the entire city government need to be replaced out there is, I think, a fair question and on the table today.
Kerry Johnson.
Ron raises some really interesting points, but what the Attorney General Eric Holder had to say yesterday was that the reason Ferguson erupted in violence after Michael Brown's death was that the city had already been primed to view the police as an oppressive force rather than a public good. That the police force, because of its interactions with the municipal courts, was viewed by people in Ferguson as a collection agency to support the city rather than to protect them in their time of need. Eric Holder said yesterday their review of the evidence and the data found no alternative explanation for some of these statistics, including things like Jamel mentioned, 95% of the people busted for jaywalking, for just walking down the street looking suspicious or bothering police, African American.
Jamel, what surprised you most about this report?
What surprised me most was the degree to which the city was heavily pushing revenue collection from the police department and from the municipal courts. You know, this problem of small municipalities needing to find as many ways to collect revenue to support their services is not unique to Ferguson. Across the country, there are plenty of metropolitan areas, but there are simply too many municipalities. What's surprising, again, is that city officials it wasn't a passive thing. It wasn't, oh, we just happened to rely heavily on fees and fines. It's that this was to the city, not just to the residents of Ferguson, to the city, the police department was more a collection agency than anything for protecting the public good or for protecting citizens from crime. And that, you know, to me is the top line thing from the report, not the emails. It is the fact that we have a city government, and likely in that area, many city governments that are devoted strictly to revenue collection. And in some sense, the infrastructure of the city is there to collect revenue, that it spends on police forces that collect revenue.
Jamel, Bowie is staff writer covering politics, policy, and race at Slate.com. Short break. We'll be right back. And to you, Carrie Johnson, there was also a lot of talk about people who had used tasers.
The use of tasers on people who were unarmed was one of the most striking elements of the report for people who had been veterans of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. This is a bad sign. And to them, it's a sign that instead of de-escalating tensions, that Ferguson police were primed to escalate even further. In other words, instead of talking or reasoning with people and finding out whether there actually was a reasonable suspicion to believe that they were engaged in some kind of criminal activity, the police's first reaction was to impose violence, tasers, canines, beatings, the like.
And David Harris, you've worked closely with police departments across the country. How much of an issue is this nationwide?
Well, what you'd find, I think, in the Department of Justice investigations, like the one in Ferguson, is that this power of the Department of Justice is used best when it involves police departments that either can't or won't change the way they operate in light of findings like we have here that shows that there's a systemic pattern of deprivation of civil rights. So I wouldn't say by any stretch that all police departments operate this way or even all small departments or anything like that. I would say that Ferguson is an example of police departments that are troubled and have problems, are focused on the wrong things, and that's the right time for the Justice Department to step in. To Ron's point about data, I'm right with him, and I would cite that the idea that police search African Americans much more routinely than whites and others when they stop them and yet find contraband less often. That when they stop African Americans, it's much more common for them to give multiple citations than it is with other groups. Those kinds of statistics, the use of force being routine and more common against them, that is really what sets the pattern, and that is why I don't think the Attorney General's comments are really out of line. The event may have spark the investigation. But once the investigation begins to show that a police department is troubled, then it is appropriate for the Justice Department to come in and do this kind of work.
Rotten Hosko.
Both reports, I think, are an important read for people listening to this show. For those in government and who are running police departments and communities, to read this report, the Patterns and Practices report, is really an instructive lead. Other small municipalities, and Jamel referred to it, there are 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. Half of them have 10 or fewer sworn officers. So training, leadership, is really paramount and difficult to get in constrained fiscal times. It's important for leadership across the country to read that report and see how things can go terribly wrong, because it could happen in your town.
Rotten Hosko, he's president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund. He's former assistant director of the FBI's Criminal Investigation Division. And now we'll take a short break. When we come back, your comments, your questions, as part of our conversation.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from CA Technologies, who believes that every business is in the software business. CA Software and Services work to help companies optimize their digital transformation in the application economy. More information is at ca.com. From Emma, email marketing for the modern brand, featuring email marketing software, automation tools to send personalized messages, and built-in analytics on desktop and mobile devices. Learn more at myemma.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the new president and CEO of NPR worked in radio for nearly two decades. But he says his experience as a business executive will strengthen the media organization. Y'all moan, and the future of public radio. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As we talk about the recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, and the release of Justice Department reports regarding that incident when a young black man, unarmed, was killed by a police officer, now it's time to open the phones. And let's go first to St. Louis, Missouri. Hi there, Tom. You're on the air.
Tom. Yes, hi. Yes, hi. I'm from the south side of St. Louis, which is the wider part of this famously segregated city, and I've participated in over a dozen protests since Michael Brown was shot, and I want to tell you why. There have been many conflicting accounts of Brown's shooting, but the one account that's most important to me is the white contractor who was on, there's video of him on CNN, and he was also from my side of town, from Jefferson County. That's where the Klan clubs are located in the St. Louis area. And this is a person who didn't know the Brown family or anyone in that area. He was just there from work. And he was the one who raised up his hands. He didn't know he was being videoed and said, why did he shoot the kid or something like that? There was no reason he needed to do that. And this is someone who had no reason culturally to be sympathetic to Brown or the neighborhood. And of all the accounts, that's the one that's most important to me. The guy didn't know he was being videoed. The video was shot seconds after the shooting. And, you know, if Brown was, if Wilson was so innocent, why did the prosecuting attorney need to run such a shoddy grand jury? You know, that's the way it looks on the ground here in St. Louis.
All right. Thanks for your call, Jamel.
You know, I've been trying very hard in covering this, especially in the last couple months, to get to not spend as much time on the Wilson on the account. Frankly, I think the DOJ report is very helpful in this because it kind of just I think it really does settle things, right? Like Darren Wilson is not the account given about Darren Wilson's actions by protesters isn't backed up by evidence. There's no evidence to support it. The only available evidence supports Wilson's account. I think what's far more important about this is just the fact that we have in the DOJ report, you know, about 4 years of data on discrimination in the area. But if you just talk to people there, this is a decade, this is 15 years of bad behavior by the city and by the police department. And that is what was fueling things. I think if you can imagine a town where something like the Brown shooting happened, but the city government was in touch with its residents, the police department was very community-oriented, there was a healthy relationship between everyone involved, and then you wouldn't have an explosion like that. I don't think you'd have one at all. It's only because of this background radiation of discrimination that you had what you had.
Carrie Johnson.
Think about the history here. This Justice Department civil rights report on the pattern or practice of discrimination by the police talks about Ferguson until the 1960s being a sundown town. In other words, African Americans were forced to leave the town after dark in Ferguson. Then you talk about a history of police canines attacking folks. There are lots of overtones and cultural issues, including described in this report, police officers competing to give the most citations to people they stop. Police officers would compete to give the most citations for people they stopped. In one case, 14 citations. This is the kind of cultural practice that is fueling distrust.
David Harris, here is an email from Nia, who says, how serious could the police force be about recruiting minorities if they do not plan to fire all the racists on the force? How safe would it be for any black person hired, trusting others with his or her life?
Well, it's an excellent question. I think what we know so far about the racist emails indicates that one person has been fired, and perhaps
right.
The others will be too. So that may resolve that way. The bigger question is whether the climate, and Mia does raise this, whether the climate within the department is welcoming to all kinds of people who would like to be police officers. One of the things you learn working with police departments is that if you expect officers to treat the public equitably and fairly, you have to have a police department that treats themselves, their officers, their own internal workings have to be fair and equitable in terms of their supervision and their relationships with each other. If that is not happening, they will not reflect well when they work with the public, and you will not get people recruited into that police force who actually you would want.
And to you, Ron Husko, here's one from Charles in Houston. He says, if the same kind of conditions in law enforcement and city government are happening in other communities around the country, what can citizens in those communities do about it? Law enforcement and government officials have extraordinary power. Average citizens seem powerless.
Well, citizens have the power to elect and to move people out of office. So I think that the best option for citizens is to exercise their rights to vote, to be loud, their First Amendment rights, to raise these issues, to collect data, to be informed citizens, and to push for change when change is needed. If these conditions exist in other places, this is a sentinel that, and certainly similar conditions are going to exist in other places. That there are other departments who are trying to be revenue generators for their city government.
All right.
Others ought to be attentive.
Let's go to Steve in Destin, Florida. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me on the
sure.
air. I'm very passionate about this topic. And I called with a question, but you have addressed it a little bit, so I've altered that question. If you'll indulge me for a moment, my original question was about your position, the panel's position on the systemic nature of the findings of this report. And but I go to another question in just a moment. And I'm getting confused now. I apologize. But my question is this. I mean, I think it's time that the media and the people that have the ear of the public, like your panel does right now, to just come to telling the absolute truth. This is not about just Michael Brown and the facts that maybe he did or did not put his hands up or whatever, or Eric Garner in New York, or the gentleman that was killed in, I believe it was Los Angeles, a few days ago. You know, I mean, the bottom line is, this report, I think, clearly states, and I think if we're just honest with the American people, this is a systemic problem with law enforcement across this country.
David Harris, is that how you see it?
There are systemic problems with law enforcement, not in every department and not with all police officers, but there are systemic problems. And that is one of the most important points to notice about the Justice Department report. That law that allows them to do that kind of investigation and report is for addressing systemic problems, not one bad incident, not two, but an institutional systemic set of problems.
Now, you have worked with the Cincinnati, Ohio Police Department. How might that work hold lessons for Ferguson?
Well, I was an observer in Cincinnati, and I can tell you that things were very bad there for any number of years. They had civil unrest for several days after the shooting of an unarmed black man named Timothy Thomas, several days of rioting, and the Department of Justice came in and did a very similar kind of sweeping investigation of the Cincinnati Police Department, and the findings were not all that different: excessive use of force, violations of the Fourth Amendment, and so forth. They prescribed, the Justice Department did, a number of steps, just like they're asking for here in Ferguson, to be followed to remake the institution of the police department. The municipality of Cincinnati and the police department agreed. It was for a 5-year period with institutional, with independent monitoring to make sure it got done. There was also, very important, a citizens collaborative for community policing that was involved in Cincinnati. That seemed to make a big difference. Now, this was not easy in Cincinnati. In fact, what I saw was a lot of foot dragging and a lot of resistance even after the agreement by the police department and the government, even throwing a monitor's agent out of the police department when she came for data. So this had to be stuck to. The federal judge had to say to the police department, we mean business, we're not going away. After 5 years, after 10 years, what you see now is a remade department in the sense that there is a relationship between the police and the people they serve. They see themselves as on the same team. The police department is responsive. They have become better crime fighters, and they're on the same team with the community. It took a lot of work and a lot of time.
Ron Husko, add to that.
Earlier this week, the President's Commission on Policing, 21st Century Policing, came out with an interim report. It was about 100 pages long. And it had any number of recommendations. Some of them are not particularly novel. David referred to some of these for improved citizen police engagement.
Give me an example.
Well, having a citizen's academy, having citizen oversight violent shooting events or involvement in those panels. So there are a number of things that any police department can and should be doing to professionalize. One of the big difficulties of law enforcement, again, referring to all of the very small, the patchwork of small law enforcement across the country, which is the bulk of law enforcement, is how do I push best practices to them? How do I push training to them? How do I take a young officer who's hired on for the right reasons, who wants to be a public servant, and keep him with that mindset across his career? How do I put him into in-service training midway? Where do the funds come to classroom setting? Make him a better cop, a more current cop, while somebody else is patrolling behind him. How do I do that financially?
Carrie.
Diane, here's one simple idea the Justice Department talks about. Ron will be intimately familiar with this, given his history in law enforcement. Get out of your police car and get into the community. As a reporter, I know I always hear more about what's going on when I go knocking on doors. Jamel, same. They just want law enforcement to do the same thing. Instead of being other, be a part of the community.
But Jamel, as an African-American and as a reporter, how were you received in the Ferguson community? Was there suspicion of you? Was there pulling away from you? Were you the other?
Yeah, I don't think that I was. I think part of that was a product of timing. I was there almost immediately after Brown shooting, and so this is before media sort of flooded the area, and so people were a little less guarded, a little more willing just to talk openly. And in all of my interactions with both white and black members of the community, people were candid. People were candid about how they felt, about their experiences, and I didn't find that I had any particular difficulty relating to people.
What do you think needs to happen to create lasting change in Ferguson?
Well, you know, realistically, I think the recommendations and the DOJ's report, sort of the broader recommendations and broader conversations about police reform, are probably on target. More working with the community, more training for officers, just more professionalization of officers. But I think if we're thinking a bit more radically, I think we have to look at just the structure of government in places like the St. Louis County area and around the country. It does not make any sense for an area the size of St. Louis County to have 90 municipalities. It does not make sense for that area to have dozens of police departments and dozens of city councils. What makes sense, if we're thinking in terms of accountability, in terms of de-incentivizing a push to collect fees, are larger city governments that encompass many more people and many more officers.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Do you think that the Ferguson Police Department needs to be dissolved?
I actually think that essentially most of those municipalities and their police departments need to be dissolved and be merged into larger organizations.
How do you feel about that, Ron Hosko?
I think that there would be economies of scale across the country to take steps to make larger police departments where you have the capacity, the internal capacity to take line officers offline and train them and make them smarter on a regular basis, establish leadership and build a culture of engagement with the community that's productive.
And if those police departments are larger, isn't that going to mean even less involvement with the community?
Not necessarily. I think you could get some economies out of that and put more officers on the street to have that interface and build relationships.
Carrie Johnson, what comes next?
So the Justice Department says it's getting signals that Ferguson authorities have been cooperative so far. They hope to reach some kind of court-enforceable settlement, Diane, that would impose an independent monitor on the Ferguson police and the municipal court system. But last night's press conference with the Ferguson mayor did not send a clear signal about that by any means. And there have been cases, there have been about 21 of these investigations in the Obama Justice Department. Most municipalities eventually settle, but a couple or three have gone on into litigation. The Justice Department says it would be much better for Ferguson to spend money changing the system than fighting the Justice Department in court. We're going to have to see what happens.
David Harris, what do you see happening next?
Well, I think they will work out a settlement in which we have a consent decree that remains in front of a federal judge to enforce for a period of 3 to 5 years. I think that's very likely. The main thing to remember is that the key to good policing is and always has been building relationships with the people who are served. And this consent decree, when it comes, if it's based upon this report and modeled after consent decrees in places like Cincinnati and other places, it will give them the structure to do that. And then what they have to do is have the will to go ahead, build those relationships, take that long road, because it won't be easy, and rebuild the trust that they need with the community. Without that, they can't function.
David Harris, professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, Ronald Husko, president of the Law Enforcement Legal Defense Fund, Carrie Johnson, justice reporter for NPR, and Jamel Bowie. He's a staff writer covering politics, policy, and race at Slate.com. Thank you all.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurblifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.